Thanks. Okay, so I would like to thank Anastasia for twisting Tvi's arm to twist my arm to talk about the work we have done on counterterms in N equals 8 supergravity. So the story here is about understanding the structure of perturbative supergravity. And that has been a long-standing question to understand the UV structure and possible divergences in point particle theories of gravity. And there's been much recent interest in that area, I think in principle in part because we have better techniques now to address the question of just calculating the amplitudes explicitly. So, well, let me see. Let me just first counter terms in N equals 8 supergravity. And I can just briefly list the references here. So the work I'll talk about was done over the past year or so. Okay. And the idea of what we wanted to study was, as opposed to try to calculate the amplitudes explicitly, we wanted to understand how the symmetries of N equals 8 supergravity could directly tell us something about the UV structure, how it constrains where the possible first UV divergence might appear. Okay, so that's the goal. Now, the basic point, and let me just structure my talk as follows. So I'm going to give an introduction with the setup of what I'll say. Then I'll talk about the constraints of supersymmetry and asymmetry. And then there's a final part which has to do with constraints of a certain symmetry called E77. And this is the part that maybe we'll just postpone that to a later time. We'll see how we do. Okay, so the basic ingredient is that if I have an L-loop divergence, then there's a corresponding counterterm that you can write down. And this counterterm is a local operator. So it's a local operator in the fields of your supergravity theory, a local operator of mass dimension, two L plus two. Now, how do you get to that? Well, whoops, I'm sorry, the gravitational coupling, and let me emphasize that everything I'm saying here is in four dimensions. So the gravitational coupling is, of course, dimensionful. So when you calculate an L loop divergence, you can calculate the powers of couplings and then work out that the corresponding operator has to have dimension 2L plus 2. Okay, so let me give you the simplest example of such an operator. If I look at scattering of gravitons, then my counterterm should be constructed out of the metric. I want something that's covariant. So I have to build it out of Riemann tensors. And so the simplest things I could write down at one loop order would be something like R squared. Now, how does the counting work? One loop, L equals 1, means dimension 4. Every Riemann tensor has two derivatives, so that counts two mass dimensions. I take two of them, I have a dimension 4 guy. Okay? Now, at one loop in four dimensions, if I can consider this on shell, I can set the Ricci tensor and Ricci scalar to 0. Then I have something like Riemann squared. But I could add in, back in those Riemanns, so those Ricci components, and then make this into a total derivative. So, in other words, I could make field redefinitions so that this operator is just a total derivative, and this is the old argument that there's no one-loop divergence in pure gravity. Okay. So now let me start here by listing a set of operators that I could possibly have. just listing gravitational objects. So I'm going to list loop level here. So 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. Now horizontally, I will list how many fields go into constructing that operator. So let me here put R cubed. You see a 2 loop, I need dimension 6 from that calculation here. So 3 Riemanns will do the job, and I'm suppressing everywhere from now on the square root minus g. Okay, so this is number of fields, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on.
You're off by 1, actually 3.
Oh, thank you. So please add 1 everywhere, thank you. Okay, so 3 loops, what can I do? I need dimension 8, so I can take 4 Riemanns. At 4 loop, 10, I could take 5 Riemanns, but I could also take 4 and dress them up with covariant derivatives, and I'm just being schematic here, not pointing out the explicit indices. 5 loop, we continue the picture. Now I can dress up the r to the 5th with 2 covariant derivatives, and I can put in an r to the 6th. And it's not to bore you, but just simply because I need it later, that I'll write out more options along the way here. So you see the pattern, I can dress up by covariant derivatives, or I can put in more Riemanns, and I always need an even number of covariant derivatives in order to be able to contract all the indices.
Why did you skip the d squared r cubed term?
D squared r cubed. Ah. So that one, so all the other ones with d squared, or the various d's on r cubed, I don't have to write down actually, they're not going to contribute. So we can come back to that. D squared r to the 5th. Sorry, what did I do here? 7 r to the 7, d squared r to the 7, r to the 8th. And let me just give 2 more. Here. And this, of course, continues. Now you see a certain pattern that when I just take Riemann tensors, then there's only, for a given loop level, I can only get up to a certain number of points. But there are, of course, many other fields in the n equals 8 theory. So there's also a question of what about sort of non purely gravitational counter terms sitting out here, non gravitational. And I put it in quotation marks because they're all in some sense gravitational, but I mean things constructed out of fields that are not just gravitons. And so that could sit out here, or they could sit and hide somehow under these ones. So think of these objects that I write here as representative for counter terms in the theory. Okay. So this part here of the blackboard will be our score sheet for the talk. All right. Now, again, the goal is to use the non-anomalous symmetries of the theory to try to rule out as many counter terms as possible over here, and then see what is left. And what is left is where the first possible divergence of the theory could set in, UV divergence of the theory could set in. Okay, so goal is twofold. One, I want to rule out candidate counter terms. And two, if I can't rule them out, I want to know as much about them as possible, so that is to characterize that whatever I can't rule out, I want to characterize the best I can. Okay. Now, to set up the problem, I want to first, let me first just remind you what n equals 8 supergravity is. So n equals 8 supergravity has 2 to the 8 massless states? They go from the positive helicity graviton, and let me list helicity here. So it has helicity plus 2. There are of course then 8 gravitinos. Let me label them by an index A going from 1 to 8 with helicity plus 3/2, and so on and so forth. There are vectors, the 28 vectors, the 56 spin 1/2 guys, so let me just list those helicities. And then there are a set of scalars that are going to play a role for us. They carry 4 indices, and these indices A, B, C throughout will run from 1 to 8. And I can continue down the spectrum. Here's the negative helicity part, minus 1/2 and so on, up to the graviton with negative helicity, which I'll call G minus. Okay, so this is the spectrum. And you can see that supersymmetry acts on this spectrum in the following way. I have supercharges that add an index, so I have 8 supercharges Q, that the way they act on the on-shell spectrum is by adding an upper index. And then there are supercharges that take you the other way, Q tilde, which act by removing the index that it carries. Okay, and we'll actually use this. So, for example, if I take my Q tilde A and act on a positive helicity graviton, it doesn't have any index to remove, so that will vanish. And so, on the other hand, if I act with the same Q1, say, on the number 1 gravitino, that's going to convert that gravitino into a positive helicity graviton, and so on. So it takes you up and down in the spectrum this way. Now these indices, 1 through 8, label an SU8 global asymmetry of the theory. This symmetry is known to be non-anomalous. And so it is naturally, together with supersymmetry, one of the symmetries that we'd like to use to constrain the possible counterterms over here on the board. Okay. One more thing about the spectrum is that there are 70 of these scalars. Now they carry indices, they carry these 4 indices labeled 1 through 8. And then the SU8, that's just basically that they transform in the fully antisymmetric 4 index of the SU8. Corresponding to this IREP here. And you can do the counting and see that 70 is indeed 8 choose 4. Okay. Now, what does it mean that SU8 is a global symmetry? Well, it means that if I try to write down an amplitude, say with a bunch of scalars and some gravitons, something like this, then I have representatives of all the 8 indices. So this is indeed something that fits nicely with the S8 invariance. So this can be non-vanishing. However, if I were to take an index and flip into like the 5 into a 1, then this is forced to vanish because of the SU8 symmetry. Okay. So in other words, if I look at an amplitude and I label all my states with upper indices, then the answer has to be SU8 invariant. The only object with only upper indices are the 8 index Lipschitz-Vidas. And so I have to basically fill out all the indices to fill up those Lipschitz-Vidas. Okay. And here clearly I'm not doing it, so I get 0. Okay, so we have to keep that in mind. Okay. Now, in addition to the global symmetry, SU8, there's also the spontaneously broken E77. And in the first part of the talk here, I'll not go into any details about it, but it plays a big role in actually constraining the counterterm, but we can take that as it comes. Good. All right, now, Zvi told me that this should be more tutorial style. So please feel free to interrupt. I'll try to make some explicit examples of how we rule out counter terms here, what the methods are. But please just ask a lot of questions along the way as we go. So far, any questions? Okay, good. So the counter terms are these operators. For example, let's just think about something like r to the 4. Now, taking four Riemann tensors, they have four indices each, Lorentz indices, and you can imagine contracting them in many different ways. And to characterize this operator, you'd have to figure out all the different inequivalent ways of contracting it, and it has to be inequivalent modulo the equations of motion. And so just doing this, even for r cubed or r to the 4, is a complicated problem. Now, in addition to that, you want to impose supersymmetry, the full n equals 8 supersymmetry on it. So even if you can figure out the independent purely gravitational pieces, now you have to fully supersymmetrize it, at least at the linearized level. And you can imagine that this is a hard problem and tedious problem to carry out. Then there's the SU8 R symmetry that we have to impose also. And just to carry it along, let me also mention E77 and come back to that a little later. So rather than trying to use maybe superfield methods or other constructions to try to construct and characterize these operators directly, what we wanted to do in this series of papers was to try to exclude the counter terms, as many as possible, and characterize them based on their symmetries, using the matrix element they produce rather than the operators themselves. Okay, so the counter terms produce matrix elements. The constraints on the counter terms turns into constraints of the matrix elements. So the requirements of supersymmetry turn into supersymmetric water identities for the matrix elements. Likewise, the SU8 R symmetry turns into water identities for the SU8. And you can see this is essentially the type of constraints that you have. Now, the E77 is a slightly different story. I'll just mention it here. Since the SU8 here is linearly realized, it has very simple water identities. The E77 is spontaneously broken, so it's non-linearly realized. And in fact, it shows up as constraints on the matrix elements through low energy theorems. And that's the second part of the talk, so couldn't put that. Okay. So here, in the first part, I'll use supersymmetry and SU8. Good. Now, what is the philosophy of the operations? Well, suppose now I go ahead and I study the matrix elements that could possibly be produced from a counter term. I'll write down the most general thing it could be. I subject it to the supersymmetry constraints and the asymmetry constraints. Then I can ask how many such matrix elements exist. If no element exists, then I'll conclude that on shell there's no such operator. If k such matrix elements exist, then I conclude that they are k independent linear supersymmetrizations respecting the asymmetry of the operator. So that's the idea. Basically, going from here back to the operators, if no possible matrix elements exist, then there can't be such a relevant, such an operator in the system. And so that's what we'll explore. Okay. So we want to exploit some of the tools from amplitudes to study this. So tool number one is dimensional analysis. Well, in spinner helicity notation, we know that both angle and square brackets are up to phases proportional to something like the corresponding Mandelstam variables, the square root of the corresponding Mandelstam variables. So in counting mass dimensions, both the angle and the square brackets here will have mass dimension 1. Okay, so that's our first tool. Our second tool is little group scaling. Now, if I look at my amplitude, some endpoint amplitude with various external states, then for the ith particle, so for each particle I, labeled say from momenta 1 through n, then the amplitude will be some function of the angle spinners, the square spinners, as well as something like a helicity label for that particle. Now if I take the amplitude and I now scale the angle spinners with some variable gi, and I scale the square spinners oppositely, then the amplitude I get out is homogeneous in ti, and it scales based on the helicity as ti to minus to the power of minus 2 times hi, where hi is the helicity of the ith particle. Okay, so that's a tool too for this. Let me just give you an example that should be quite familiar. So if, for example, I take the Park-Taylor amplitude, then let me take one where now these particles are all gluons. I take the first two to be negative helicity, the rest to be positive helicity. The Park-Taylor formula is the following: the angle bracket of the two negative helicity guys to the fourth power, and then the cyclic product of all the other ones, like this. And if I scale, for example, the angle brackets and square brackets of particle 3, according to my rule over here, what I pick up is from the denominator here, that's the only place where I get a scaling, so I get t to the I minus, well, one from the 2-3 bracket, one from the 3-4 bracket, nothing else. So I get t to the minus 2, and this is indeed minus 2 times plus 1, which was the helicity of particle number 3. So the scaling works, and you see that the factor here in the numerator precisely accounts to the 4th power, precisely accounts to flip the helicity scaling of the two negative helicity particles according to this rule. The second thing you see is the mass dimension of this amplitude is, well, 4 powers upstairs, n powers downstairs, so this is 4 minus n. And so this is also just a clear example of what it should be, actually. Okay. Good. Tool number 3 are the supersymmetric water entities. Which is, of course, one of my constraints here. So what are the supersymmetric water entities? Well, the idea is the following. Suppose I take the supersymmetric vacuum, and I sandwich between the supersymmetric vacuum a commutator of the Suzy generator with a string of various, let me call them AN, of various creation operators or annihilation operators for states. Then clearly, because the Susi charge annihilates the vacuum. This has to be zero. On the other hand, Q can go in and act consecutively on each of the operators, and then I get a sum of basically, let me sum over one, over I equals one through n of the n states. So I get some set of string of creation annihilation operators where Q act on the ith one. This of course gives some new state. And then if you work out what the algebra is of the action of the Susi charges on the states, you'll find that this turns into a sum of basically, it could be something like angle brackets of the Susi parameter I dotted in with a momentum particle J times amplitudes with the corresponding states corresponding to these creation annihilation operators. And this is valid at any loop order. Now, why did I take a commutator here? Well, I'm really envisioning Q here to be your usual spinorial Q generator dotted in with the appropriate Grassmann variable. So that's why I'm looking at commutators. And this is why this Susi parameter epsilon appears up here too. Okay, so this has been known since the 70s that there are such constraints. And let's do an example. So if I take my Susi vacuum here, and I take what I called, let me call it Q tilde number one. Of course, there are eight of these Susi charges, and then I let it act on a positive helicity gravitino and a string of positive helicity or negative helicity guy. Well, let me just make them all positive helicity here. Okay, like this. Now recall that the way Q tilde acts is to remove an upper index matching its own, so it'll convert this fermion into a positive helicity graviton, but the gravitons will be annihilated. They don't have any indices to be removed. And so what I end up with here is angle momentum number one times the all plus amplitude. And so I conclude that the all plus amplitude in a supersymmetric theory, see, I actually only used one supersymmetry here, so the all plus amplitude has to vanish. And likewise, you can show that the all plus with a single minus endpoint, unless n is 3, also has to vanish. So these are the simplest examples of constraints of supersymmetry. Now, there's also, well, one step up in complexity are the so-called MHV amplitudes, the maximally helicity violating amplitudes. And as almost everybody here probably knows, if I take an amplitude with, say, negative helicities on the first two lines and the rest positive helicity gravitons, then that, by the n equals h supergravity, is required to be the same as the amplitude where I put, I've moved these negative helicities to two other lines, and I just compensate by putting in a set of spinor brackets here to the 8th power. Okay. So this is also a consequence of supersymmetry and the maximal supersymmetry in n equals 8. Okay. Good. All right, so those are our tools. Now let's apply them to try to do some damage over here in this sheet. Good. I'm going to erase the middle part here so I can point to the rules. And I'm going to start with the first case here, R cubed. Now, R cubed, let me take the metric, expand it around the Minkowski space, then you see that what this operator will give us is something with two derivatives acting on the graviton field to the cube power with some way of contracting the indices, and of course plus higher order terms. Now, as you'll see, and as you'll see for any one of these operators, the leading interaction you get is always going to be local. All the interactions are of course going to be local, but I'm going to focus for each of them on the leading order piece. Okay. So what does it say here? Well, we have six derivatives in total for this Feynman rule. This matches well with it being dimension six, which is 2L plus 2. So indeed, this was of course why this was the two-loop candidate counterterm. Now, I have my constraints of the little group scaling, as well as the dimensional scaling here, the dimension of the matrix element. So what I want to say here is that if I look at a three-point matrix element corresponding to this interaction, it has to have in it these six powers of momenta dotted in with three polarizations for the gravitons in some way. What this statement turns into is that if I count the dimension, once I convert it into angle and square spinners, it has to have dimension six. It has to respect this little group scaling. And then furthermore, there's a constraint that the special kinematics, special three-point kinematics, let me say that I choose it to only allow me angle spinners. So the three-point kinematics is constrained, so I can constrain it such that all the squares vanish. Now then, when you combine these constraints, you can see that it's not possible to construct a matrix element with mixed helicities. It simply does not work. Okay, you can't do it. Another way of arguing this is to basically spinnerize this interaction by contracting with gamma matrices. And in the end, what you get then is that you can see that the only thing that is allowed is matrix elements where all the helicities are the same. And let me just write down the answer to you and then try to argue that this is the only thing that you are allowed to have. Okay, so up to some constant. So what did I write down? Well, I wrote down the only three spinner brackets I can have, angle spinner brackets for three particles. And you'd notice that it's fully symmetric in 1, 2, and 3, as it must be, because these are, of course, bosons, non-ordered. And what I see is also I have used a total of six brackets, so this matches that this has dimension 6, okay, mass dimension 6. And secondly, you can also look at the little group scaling and see that it's exactly compatible with the little group scaling that it's supposed to have from here. Now, you can try to play around with angle brackets and you can convince yourself then that this is really the only thing that you can possibly write down. Okay, but now, over here I said that supersymmetry requires that all amplitudes with exactly the same helicities, either all plus or conjugate or minus, have to vanish. So, this tells you that R cubed is not compatible with the supersymmetry. Now you might object a little and say, really, if I'm using real momenta and a proper Lorentzian signature, these matrix elements will all vanish, so I haven't shown you anything. But you can very easily actually recurse this vertex according to a paper Michael and I wrote with a collaborator. You can very easily recurse this and find that the corresponding all minus 4-point matrix element also vanishes. Also does not vanish, that's the important point. So it violates supersymmetry directly, and this has been known for a long time. This is result of a combined effort of von Nieuwenhuysen, Wu, and Grisseroux from the 70s. So nothing new there. The conclusion is that R cubed is ruled out, and that certainly is well known. It's ruled out because it produces helicity violating amplitudes. Okay. All right, so now let me turn to a slightly less trivial example. I'm going to upgrade here to out of the fifth.
That's the same reason you left out the whole tower there of higher derivatives?
Essentially, yeah. If I start putting on more derivatives here, I think I'm just going to turn things into total derivatives. So I'm not going to gain anything from the procedure. Now I'm going to jump, I'm going to skip the out of the four and the d squared out of the four for a reason I'll explain in a minute, and then now rule out, show you how to rule out the out of the fifth. Okay. So out of the fifth, it's sort of the same story. Now I have five powers, so this becomes dimension 10. Okay. But now I have to be a little more careful in my analysis. So the first thing that I have to put in is that the constraint here of locality. So the fact that this vertex is local means that the matrix element must be some polynomial, again, in momenta and polarization vectors dotted into each other. When you convert this to spinner brackets, that means that the result has to be a polynomial in angle and square spinners. Okay? So locality means that the matrix element must be a polynomial in the angles and the squares. Good. Now, let me do the little group scaling. And let me then, to do that, choose a particular amplitude, namely one where my first two lines have negative helicity, and the three other ones have positive helicity. So, of course, I have a total of five, because there are now five gravitons entering the leading matrix, the leading interaction here. So little group scaling tells me that since I have to be polynomial in angle and squares, I have to use four of the angle spinners for one. I mean, I have to have a net four angle spinners of one in the end, a net of angle spinner two in the end. And for three and four and five, I also need to have a net of four of them in order to get this to scale as t to the minus 2 hi on the little group. Now let me just see what would happen if I just contract these spinners in the only possible non-zero way that I can contract them. Well, angle has to contract with angle, so I get angle 1, 2 to the fourth power. And then the only way I can get something non-zero, remembering that the square brackets are anti-symmetric as well as the angle brackets, gives me a 3, 4 squared, 4, 5 squared, 5, 3 squared. And now if I then count dimensionally, then I have 4 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2, that's 10. So I've accounted for all the momentum factors I'm allowed to have here. And so there's actually nothing else I can put in. You could have imagined that if my dimension was higher, I could have put in various extra Mandelstam variables, which don't scale under the little group scaling. But I'm not allowed to do that here, because if I put in a factor of a Mandelstam variable, then the dimension gets too high. If I put in a ratio of Mandelstam variables, I'm introducing a pole, and that contradicts the fact that my interaction here is completely local. There are no propagators or anything else showing up. It's just that. Okay? Make sense? All right. So I've shown that the constraints, combined constraints of dimensional analysis and little group scaling, completely fixes my matrix element here up to some constant, let me call it C. Good. Now, let me just repeat the analysis for a slightly special case, slightly different case, where I now choose to put my negative helicity guys on two other legs, 3 and 4. And of course, I can complete the same argument, or I can just say it's going to be the same. It's going to be the constant times now angle 3, 4 to the fourth power, and then the cyclic product now 1, 2 squared to 5. Squared, 5, 1, squared. Good. But now coming to my MHV Susi constraint, I know that the second matrix element I just wrote down has to be proportional to the first one I wrote down. Let me actually just flip this constant over to the other side. So what I get here is that this has to be, by supersymmetry, this has to be the same as angle 3, 4 to the 8th divided by angle 2, 4, 1, 2 to the 8th times the matrix element that I had over here, minus, minus, plus, plus, plus. And so if I plug in, I'll see that this gives me a 3, 4 angle bracket to the 8th times 3, 4 to the 4th, 4, 5, sorry, squared, 5, 3 squared times 1 divided by 1, 2 angle bracket to the 4th power. So now I have a conflict, because even if I try to use momentum conservation or similar, there's no way that I can cancel this pole. When 1 and 2 become collinear, there's a pole in this matrix element, whereas that other matrix element that has to be valid for the same amplitude is local, it doesn't have a pole, and so I end up with a conflict between the requirements of locality and supersymmetry. What does it tell me? Well, it tells me that the r to the fifth is not supersymmetrizable. And so I can go out and I can remove it as a candidate counterterm. Okay. Now, in fact, continuing this thought ahead.
There's no way that the numerator could vanish.
Oh, this, you mean this numerator here, that both numerators could vanish, not for generic momenta. No, of course, as I start maybe taking more collinear or something like this, I could make things become zero. But this has to be true for all momenta. I have to be able to supersymmetrize this for all momenta. Okay, and that's
it. I don't know, it seems almost too simple.
Good. I'm glad you think so. So it is in fact very, very simple, right? I mean it's a very simple constraint that just gives you the requirement of locality and supersymmetry, just you can't do it. You can imagine, of course, that if I had less supersymmetry, in a sense I get weaker constraints here, and so you might be able to do something. Or to put it differently.
What do you mean when you say it's not supersymmetrizable? You just mean I cannot write down a chain of operators built out of this non-gravitational implication?
I mean that any operator of dimension 10 that at the lowest level involve 5 fields is not supersymmetrizable. Now you could have argued, well, I told you this argument only for external gravitons. So you can object and say you only showed it for gravitons. What about fermions and other things? Well, actually, these Susi-Ward entities at the MHV level tell you that all those other matrix elements will be proportional to the purely gravitational ones by similar Ward entities as these ones. So I actually rule out the whole slew in one go. You could also say, well, why does it have to be MHV? Well, it can't be less, because then it would vanish or violate supersymmetry directly, so I could throw this away. Or you could say, well, what if it had 3 negative ellipticities and 2 positive? Then it's next to MHV. But of course, this is just conjugate to the MHV, and so I'm back in the same situation. So that makes 5-point particularly simple. Yes?
In your argument, don't you assume that the supersymmetry transformations don't get modified?
That's right. But I'm looking for the first and leading divergence. So my argument is not that this operator could never appear in a as a counterterm. If there are lower operators, they could possibly influence this one. And as you say, I think the argument equivalently would be that if I have a lower counterterm operator, you can modify the supersymmetries. Or as I would say, well, if there are lower operators, they can influence the higher ones, the higher order ones, by introducing pole terms in the amplitudes. And then my locality argument, of course, breaks down. So this is an important point. I'm always looking for the first divergence, the first possible counterterm that can show up, and there are no corrections to the Susi transformations then.
Good. So you have to discuss away the r to the 4.
Absolutely. Good. So let's discuss r to the 4. So the logic is, of course, the if, that if this were the first counter term, I can exclude it as the first counter term. I cannot exclude it as a lower counter term before I've excluded other ones. Good. All right. Well. So, what about R to the 4? I skipped it for the following reason. I know that an R to the 4 is generated by in the closed string effect of action. So I know it's compatible with the n equals 8 supersymmetry. So I won't expect to be able to exclude it based on supersymmetry. And in fact, if I were to repeat this argument, then I would get that minus minus plus plus, well, it has to be dimension 8. This is 1, 2 to the 4th power, square bracket 3, 4 to the 4th power. Whereas the other one with helicities flipped would be square 1, 2 to the 4th power, angle 3, 4 to the 4th power. You see again, this is actually turns out to be unique. This is dimension 8, which is the right thing for R to the 4. And so if I look at the ratio of those two, and ask if they obey, well, or you could ask about locality if you wish, or if they obey the Susie-Wardell entities, I'll find that it actually works. Now, what do I get? I get 3, 4, let me just rewrite it, 1, 2, to the 4th power, 3, 4, to the 4th power, 1, 2, to the 4th power, 3, 4, to the 4th power. But now I'm at 4 point, and I can use momentum conservation. For example, I could multiply by an extra 4 powers of 3, 4. Then this is the Mandelstam variable 3, 4, which is the same as the Mandelstam variable 1, 2. So this is the same as angle 1, 2 to the 4th square, 1, 2 to the 4th. So what do I get out? I just get out that, well, I get angle 1, 2 to the 8th power divided by 3, 4 to the 8th power. And this is indeed the requirement of my water density. Okay, so I cannot exclude this guy by supersymmetry. And so let me put a green box around it. Now, just because I can't exclude it doesn't mean that it will show up, of course. So I can still work under the assumption that if this doesn't show up, if the three-loop four-point amplitude is finite, which we know from Zwie and collaborators' calculation that it actually is, then I'm still okay ruling out the R to the fifth or this one if I need to. And so let me actually go ahead and look at this operator here. D squared, R to the 4. Well, it turns out that the form of the amplitudes for this operator have to take the form of some polynomial in S, T, and U times whatever the matrix element was for the R to the 4. And this is for the four-point matrix element, so let's write that. Okay. Now, by dimension analysis, this polynomial has to be linear in S, T, and U. And by Bose symmetry, it has to be symmetric. And so, of course, these two combinations mean that F has to be S plus T plus U, but that vanishes, so there is no such operator on shell. Now, the fact that these operators are ruled out was actually already known in the literature. So we didn't prove anything new here, but this was sort of just the warm-up to show you and illustrate how the methods work.
R to the 4, that's the end of the story as far as you're concerned?
No. It's not the end of the story. It's the end of the story for right now. Now, let me mention that the explicit calculation of 4.3 and 4 loop amplitudes says that there are no such 4-point operator generated in the perturbative expansion in the perturbation theory of n equals 4. There are no divergences in those 4-point amplitudes. Now,
clarify that point, because that their calculation doesn't necessarily rule out the existence of
exactly. So that's not what I said either. So their calculation doesn't rule out that this operator could be compatible with everything, but it shows that if it's compatible with anything, the coefficient comes out as zero. So even whether I rule in something in the sense that it's a candidate counterterm, I can certainly not say anything about whether it's produced perturbatively or not. Good. Okay. Good. So there is, in fact, because of this, a call for understanding why the three-loop calculation turned out to be finite when it appeared that supersymmetry allowed this term. And so, as you can imagine, this is where what I erased, the E77 part of the story, comes in. Okay. Now, one thing that the explicit calculations don't show is whether the higher point amplitudes could possibly have divergences. We can see here that it shouldn't happen at the MHV level, because the MHV level are always proportional to gravitational counterterms, and there's nothing available here. So on the other hand, you could imagine building something out of 8 derivatives acting on scalars, if you wish. That would have the right mass dimension. And this is what I meant early on when I said, are there non-gravitational counterterms out here? Now, if you're doing this in Young-Mills theory, you would get a better convergence at higher point, because every time you insert a higher point, you also have a new propagator, and the vertices only go at worst linearly in momentum, whereas the propagators go, of course, as 1 over momentum squared. But in gravity, all the interactions are 2-particle interactions, so at least, I mean, you get the same naive degree of divergence at higher point as you do at lower point. So there's certainly a question here of whether the 4-point calculation was enough to rule out anything else. Okay, so if I go and look at this calculation here for out of the fifth, then I say, well, suppose that I allowed myself to be a higher dimension than 10. For example, I go to the d squared out of the fifth, then I'm allowed to have any set of extra Mandelstam variables stuck in here, at least linear power, polynomial, and Mandelstam variables at 5-point. And of course, this could allow me some extra powers, say I stick in powers of Mandelstams 1, 2. It doesn't scale, it just changes the dimension. And so for every power, for every set of 2 derivatives, I can stick in extra powers of these ones, and eventually I'll have enough to cancel off the 1, 2 to the 4th. How many do I need? Well, I need 4 of them. That corresponds to having 8 derivatives. So I'm giving you now a heuristic argument that anything, and you have to be a little more careful in the actual analysis, but anything that less than 8 derivatives at the MHV level is ruled out. And so we could continue this analysis at 5-point and rule out everything here up to this one with 8 derivatives. And that indeed is not ruled out by supersymmetry, and you can show that there exists such a linearly supersymmetrizable counterterm at this order, and it's unique. Okay, but you need at least 8 derivatives, and the formal proof that this is always the case for MHV, that you need 8 derivatives, is something that we carried out. So what should I say here? So MHV for more than 5 fields, 5 or more, you need d to the 2k, r to the n, and you need k to be greater than or equal to 4 for this to be okay. Anything else is ruled out. Okay, now, what about the 4-point? Well, 4-point kinematics is special, as we saw, it's not as constrained, and so in fact, these 2 operators here are allowed by supersymmetry, and so are all these ones also. So they are not ruled out by supersymmetry or the R-symmetry. So what about these questions of higher point up here? Well, once I start to 6-point, then the NMHV analysis has to kick in. I could already say by my MHV analysis that none of these guys here can have independent MHV-like supersymmetrizations. So what can I do beyond the MHV level? Okay, well, beyond the MHV level, the SUSY constraints are not as simple as at MHV level over here. Now remember again that the SUSY ward identities came out by commutators of SUSYs with state sandwiched between the supersymmetric vacuum. But as you go, and as a consequence of that, the MHV amplitudes are all proportional to each other. Now you go to the NMHV level, what you get is a more complicated system of some coupled linear system of amplitudes. And it's much harder to solve and figure out what the independent amplitudes actually are. So in order to do this analysis at the NMHV level, you need to be able to control the SUSY ward identities beyond MHV. And luckily, that's a problem that has been solved. And the idea is the following. Instead of working here in terms of explicit amplitudes, then you can actually convert the problem of the SUSY ward identities into one about superamplitudes. So superamplitudes, Emery, Sokachev reviewed them for us in N equals 4, super young Mills. They're there also in N equals 8, supergravity. The idea is just the following. You introduce some super wave function that encodes all your states from the positive velocity gravitons and then the gravitinos. So you introduce a set of bookkeeping variables or on-shell superfields, eta, which are Grassmann, for all the fields, like this. And now you consider your amplitude as function of these super wave functions. So this is a Grassmann polynomial. And its degree is 8k plus 2, where k denotes the n to the k MHV level of the amplitudes. Okay, now every coefficient of this Grassmann polynomial is an actual amplitude. And you project out the amplitude that you want by projecting out the states that you want from the corresponding superwave function. So if I want a negative velocity graviton, then I add with 8 Grassmann variables with index that correspond to sort of the i-th. If this has momentum I, then there's an I that follows along here everywhere. And so you contract, extract your superamplitude from your superamplitude, the explicit amplitudes. Now then the statement of the SUSY ward identities simply becomes the statement that the SUSY charges annihilate the superamplitude. And so this makes the problem much more easy to handle rather than keeping track of everything separately for component amplitudes in some complicated linear system, coupled linear system up here. Now you just have an operator statement and you have to constrain Grassmann polynomials so that they're satisfying these constraints, as well as equivalent statements about the R symmetry, which turn out to be non-trivial. So this was a problem that Michael Kiermaier, Dan Friedman, and I solved last fall for N equals 4 and N equals 8, N equals 4 super young Mills and N equals 8 supergravity. And the answer is that you can write the superamplitudes as a sum of SUSY and R symmetry invariant polynomials, each of which have a coefficient, which is in some sense a basis amplitude for determining the whole amplitude, the whole superamplitude. And so we showed that the basis amplitudes you need, the explicit amplitudes that you need, are in one-to-one correspondence with a semi-standard tableau of a certain set of representations of SU n minus 4. So If I study the endpoint amplitude, I have to look at irreducible representations of SU n minus 4 corresponding to Young diagrams, which have, in the case of n equals 8, they had 8 columns. In case of n equals 4 superangles, they had 8 four columns, and they have k rows. So MHV corresponds to 0 rows, so there's just a unique amplitude that determines everything. It's the singlet representation corresponding to this guy, trivial representation. Whereas as you go up and into the k level, you need more and more to determine this question. And again, the semi-standard tableau of these guys is in one-to-one correspondence with the actual amplitude you need. And so this was one piece of information that we needed. Being able to control the Susi water identities was necessary in order to rule out, say, NMHV counter terms up here. The second piece we needed was techniques for constructing polynomials. So what I showed you earlier was that I constructed the most general polynomial of the certain degree with the right little group scaling. And it was very easy because things were very constrained and low dimensions. But as I go up, there are many different ways I construct these polynomials, and I need a systematic approach to do it. And the Gruppner basis is such a systematic approach. So it's too bad Kosover isn't here, because I think he was happy about the Gruppner basis too. So what does it mean? Well, I look at the polynomial ring of consisting of all polynomials in all my angle and square brackets. But these are, of course, not independent, so I need to mod out by the ideal generated by the constraints of Skouden identities as well as momentum conservation. And the Gruppner basis techniques using the Buchberger algorithm then allow us to write down basis elements or generate systematically basis elements with the correct mass dimension and the correct scaling dimension. And then we, on top of that, have to put in the constraints of supersymmetry, both symmetry, and so on. So this gets involved, but you can do it. And it allowed us to rule out all NMHV contributions out here, NMHV. There can be no non-gravitational NMHV hiding anywhere out here or inside the diagram, at least below 6 loop order, oh, below 7 loop order. So let me draw a special line. So it ruled out completely counter terms like r to the 6 also. D to the square r to the 6 was ruled out. R to the 7 was ruled out by the same techniques. It ruled out d squared r to the 7 down here. But it did not rule out at first sight something like d squared out of the 6, and we could actually construct explicitly an example of such a matrix element, and that turns out to actually be 2 of these ones available at the MHV level. This one is not ruled out either. This can appear at next to MHV level, and so on. And we could also formulate a conjecture based on our observations that there could be no n to the k MHV out here below 7 loop order, but they could start appearing here in the form of something that looks like phi squared, schematically phi squared r to the 8th entering, this is 10 point entering at the n cubed MHV level, and so on. So there can be stuff appearing out here starting at 7 loop order. Now the conjecture that we set here, we had a bound based on the n to the k level and the mass level it could first set in. And that bound was then proven later, about half a year later, by Heslop and Drummond and Howe, using a different technique. Okay, so this is where we stand. After imposing the constraints of supersymmetry and asymmetry, we see that below 7 loop order, things are very constrained. There are 3 candidates that we need to account for. Above 7 loop order, everything starts becoming possible. In fact, there's an infinite tower of counter terms with higher and higher multiplicities appearing here, starting at 7 loop order and 8 loop order as well, any loop order. And so the equivalent statement from a superfield point of view, analysis point of view, is that starting at 7 loop, you can have full superspace integrals, so sort of D term counter terms, as opposed to these ones, which are F term style. Okay. Now, this is probably a good place to stop. And I don't know, should we try to talk about E77 at the people interested in that?
We can either do it tomorrow, maybe there'll be a little time after, or maybe tomorrow afternoon we should do it.
It's fine with me.
Let's hear about E77.
So as the cliffhanger, so...
You have to give the punchline, though.
Yeah, that's right.
So I should make sure to give the punchline. So the color for E77 is going to be blue. And E77 allows us, through use of low energy theorems and a fun analysis, which you'll hear about tomorrow maybe, or this, well, whenever the talk will be, allows us to rule out of the 4, d to the 4 out of the 4, and d to the 6 out of the 4. And in order to do this, we have to, we have to use a trick to get the right matrix elements by using string amplitudes, extracting the correct. The string amplitudes are not quite the correct matrix elements for this one. We have to extract them through a certain average procedure and then take soft energy theorems. And there's a nice story about how the actual soft energy theorems, well, the non-vanishing of the soft limits allow you to rule out these, but the actual values of the soft limits also tell you something about the structure of the string amplitude at tree level. And it also allows you to match the actual values of the soft energy limits to an analysis of Michael Green, Rousseau, Van Hover, and Miller that said that these, based on duality and supersymmetry arguments, they said that if you take these type of counter terms or operators in d dimensions, then they have to be dressed up with moduli-dependent functions, which have to satisfy certain Laplacian-style equations, and we can match our soft energy limits to the requirements of those Laplacian equations. So with that trailer, I hope to see you for next part.
Just one very quick.
Yes.
You mentioned at the very end results at Tower and collaborators.
Yes.
The paper from yesterday. Can you comment? Did you see more than what
I see.
We can...
Good. So the question of Pierre van Hauw's and Pierre van Hove's paper,
yes.
from yesterday. Yes, good. So in a parallel movement, there are several parallel movements, I guess. One movement that's already, it goes back to the 80s, is to construct candidate counter terms based on superfield methods, in particular harmonic superspace, is one way. Now, it was known very early on, 81 or so, that you could write down a supersymmetric seven loop counter term as a full superspace integral. But it was then pointed out that then that counter term was not E77 invariant. On the other hand, independently, Kalash and Lindstrom and Howe, I think, constructed an eight loop counter term which would correspond to this one. So there is a candidate counter term with all the right properties, E77 and eight loop order. Then it was said in the literature that there's actually also a natural candidate for a seven loop counter term with all the right duality properties. And that would be the full superspace integral over the volume of superspace. But it was known that in lower supersymmetry, such integrals over superspace would vanish. Okay. So the question was if it would vanish or not. And this has been standing for at least 2 years, whether this n equals 8 integral over superspace would vanish or not. And the paper yesterday, the first result of that paper, the two results, the first one is that superspace integral actually does vanish.
Can you prove the same thing with your methods or your...
Let me answer that by first. Well, I'll answer. Let me say two things. So, no, I cannot prove something about the specific superintegral by my methods. The second part is that what the result of the paper from yesterday also showed was that instead of having this superspace, full superspace integral, you can use harmonic superspace to write down an integral which, instead of being d32 theta of something, is a d28 theta of something, which has all the correct properties, and they claim that it's non-vanishing, and so that would be a new counter term corresponding to the d to the 8 out of the 4. Now, just one more comment, which is to what can I prove about seven loops? I can prove that the seven loop amplitude is completely controlled by the 4-point amplitude. So even if I couldn't rule out by supersymmetry these operators here, I can rule out that they are the first divergences also using E77. So these ones will also be ruled out by E77 as the candidate first counter term. So that means that the first object that could be divergent would be the seven loop counter term, seven loop 4-point amplitude. If that turns out to be finite, then the whole seven loop sector is finite. Then you have to go to eight loop. So this was not given a priori, but that's one thing you can show.